All right, welcome. I hope I am
greetings.
The person who has the first chance to welcome you to this year's Dragon Con. I don't know about you all, but I am incredibly excited to be here. To me, this is my annual nerd pilgrimage, and I just absolutely love it.
Woohoo!
Well, that was my cue. All right.
Woohoo!
All right, how many people here have been to an EFF track? How many people have been to an EFF track? All right, we got a couple. Well, an EFF panel, which you're at now. Okay, for those of you who haven't, I know Dragon Con has a lot of the most fun, entertaining, great panels. But if you want to learn something, if you want to hear about the most cutting-edge issues of the day, EFF is your best bet. And we've got an amazing speaker or presentation, I think, to give you today. Now, to start this off, I've been giving presentations with EFF for about 4 years, and we were just talking about this, that our favorite part of the panel isn't what we give to y'all, it's what y'all give to us. Because the people...
Preferably in 10s and 20s, of course.
Right. People who come to EFF panels are really some of the brightest, smartest, best educated people that I encounter all year.
Except for this group.
Oh, clearly. That side of the room is kind of rough.
It's early, though.
Electronic Frontier Foundation. So we're going to ask, as we present, if anyone has a thought, if you want to discuss something, if you want to respond to something we've said, raise your hand, we'll call on you. And if someone wants to respond to anything anyone else has said, you know, respectfully wait for them to finish, and then we'll give you a chance. So we'd like this to be more of a discussion, not just a speech.
We actually have a mic over here for the person to speak, because this is being recorded for legal purposes, for future replays. So wait for the mic, otherwise you won't be heard on the recording. Right, you have a mic, right, Scott? You have a mic? You have a mic for them to...
It's right there.
It's out there. Okay. Well, come up to the front when you want to ask a question, and we'll just wait. There's only one person here to work.
All right. Cool. Well,
should we introduce ourselves?
Yeah, I think we should introduce ourselves.
That's probably a good idea.
My name's Cliff Tunnell. I'm a patent attorney, which means I'm registered to practice before the United States Patent and Trademark Office. I received my law degree from the University of Alabama and my electrical engineering degree from Auburn. Currently, I work in Atlanta with a firm called Anderson Daly, and we do IP law, business litigation, things like that.
Cool. And I'm Randall Schwartz. You have a slide on that. There goes kick. I had a lot more words on my slide because he just took my my bio for the Dragon Con and pasted it in there. But he left off the words at the end, and he wins karaoke contests regularly. So that part, it got left off of this. But I might accidentally break into a song. That's kind of the way it works. Especially if you come to the Hacker 101 or 201 panels. I'm sure I'm going to sing at least once there. But I've been involved in the computer industry for 30 years professionally. God, is it 30 years? Yeah. I've been involved on all sides of the law. Some of you saw my first presentation here 6 years ago. It's my sixth Dragon Con. I talked about a landmark legal case where I was convicted of three felonies for what I thought was doing my job. By the way, for those that didn't come the last couple of years, it was expunged 2 years ago. So I am now no longer a felon. I can legally say I've never been convicted of a crime. So, yeah. And it's not like it took a lot of work, it just took time. I had to wait 10 years, so, and then it came off my record. But it's funny because I actually threw a party a couple years ago, but I said I didn't really want, since the party was about the sealing of records, I said, what can I call the party? So I called it the Nothing to See Here party. And it was a lot of fun. And I was gonna make it an annual tradition, but I have other things to do. So I'm a podcast publisher. I produce a show called Floss Weekly. How many people here listen to Floss Weekly? Three. All right, cool. All right. It's a podcast on open source software, and we get some of the biggest names in the industry to talk to us for an hour. And it comes out every week, as the name might imply, Floss Weekly. It's up to about 50,000 downloads now, so I'm really happy with that. I actually have a podcast where I'm speaking to 50,000 people every week. It's quite phenomenal. It's the number one rated open source podcast on iTunes, so I love it. Good thing. That's probably enough about me. You'll hear more about me on Hacker 101.
Okay. Now, before we dive into the issues, I just wanted us to have a little perspective on our current president. Despite the overwhelming media attention he's garnered, he's really still fairly fresh on the scene. I think you can really consider the first point when he came to national attention is when he announced his candidacy for president. And that was not too long ago, in February of 2000.
2007. In June of 2008, once all the states were counted, Obama was named as the Democratic Party presidential nominee. After that, on November 4th of 2008, Obama won the presidency with 52.9% of the popular vote. And then he was inaugurated as president in January 20th of this year. So for the purposes of this speech, Obama's only got a record of about 7.5 months in office. All right, the first topic I'd like to cover is science policy and federal spending. Two things that Obama really focused on in his campaign were that when he was elected, he was going to change the government posture to one that embraced science and technology. And the other thing is that he said that with the next federal budget, he was going to increase science funding over 10 years to 2016. For anyone in the audience, what do you think he meant when he said that he was going to change how the government embraces science and technology?
I was more curious as to what he thought the posture was before. Did anyone bother to characterize the existing posture of the government?
Good point.
Would you like to respond?
Yeah, I think basically there was a lot of debunking going on, particularly in regards to global warming, where
That's correct.
And that's the major difference, I think. It's like, as opposed to letting policy set scientific parameters with what science dictate policy, or at least point the direction towards, I think, is the major difference.
Right. Basically, the biggest criticism of the previous administration, or the Bush administration, is that he had distorted a lot of the scientific studies of his own advisors. He'd redacted them, he'd suppressed them, and that many of them were censored. And so even with freedom of information requests, you couldn't get your hands on them. And Obama's stance was that he was going to try to make his policies strictly in line with what the results were, regardless of whether or not that was something that his political background agreed with. All right, some of the actions Obama has taken in his science policy so far. In January, during his inauguration speech, I thought it was very impressive that he specifically mentioned science, because that's a topic you really don't hear much about in politics. And he again reiterated that he wanted to return science to its rightful place. In March of this year, he released an executive memorandum for the heads of all of his major agencies, basically telling them that in their decisions and in their policies, scientific and technological information should be key. And in this memo that he sent them, there were three points that were very important. The first one is that political officials should not suppress or alter scientific or technological findings and conclusions. He also said that when he appoint positions in the executive branch, it shouldn't be on personal or political connections. It should be based on what their background is, what their experience is, what their qualifications are. And finally, and this is something some of y'all may want to discuss, is that there should be transparency in how the reports are made, such that the evidence trail you can see from the beginning to the end how the conclusions are drawn. And this is Obama speaking about his policy.
Over the past few weeks, Vice President-elect Biden and I have announced some of the leaders who will advise us as we seek to meet America's 21st century.
Apparently, he spoke very quietly.
Strengthening our security, rebuilding our economy.
You can try this again.
And he can hold pose just like that. That's really cool.
Okay, you can try it.
Whoa.
Over the past few weeks, Vice President-elect Biden and I have announced some of the leaders who will advise us as we seek to meet America's 21st century challenges, from strengthening our security, to rebuilding our economy, to preserving our planet for our children and our grandchildren. Whether it's the science to slow global warming, the technology to protect our troops, confront bioterror and weapons of mass destruction, the research to find life-saving cures, or the innovations to remake our industries and create 21st century jobs. Today, more than ever before, science holds the key to our survival as a planet and our security and prosperity as a nation. It's time we once again put science at the top of our agenda and worked to restore America's place as the world leader in science and technology. Right now, in labs, classrooms, and companies across America, our leading minds are hard at work chasing the next big idea, on the cusp of breakthroughs that could revolutionize our lives. But history tells us that they can't do it alone. From landing on the moon, to sequencing the human genome, to inventing the internet, America has been the first to cross that new frontier because we had leaders who paved the way. Leaders like President Kennedy, who inspired us to push the boundaries of the known world and achieve the impossible. Leaders who not only invested in our scientists, but who respected the integrity of the scientific process. Because the truth is that promoting science isn't just about providing resources. It's about protecting free and open inquiry. It's about ensuring that facts and evidence are never twisted or obscured by politics or ideology. It's about listening to what our scientists have to say, even when it's inconvenient, especially when it's inconvenient. Because the highest purpose of science is the search for knowledge, truth, and a greater understanding of the world around us. I'm confident that if we recommit ourselves to discovery, if we support science education to create the next generation of scientists and engineers right here in America, if we have the vision to believe and invest in the things unseen, then we can lead the world into a new future of peace and prosperity.
We will do enterprises with a national currency, spurred innovation, and ignited America's imagination with a National Academy of Sciences, believing we must, as he put it, add the fuel of interest to the fire of genius in the discovery of new and useful things. On this day, it is also the bicentennial of Charles Darwin's birth. To pause and renew that commitment to science and innovation and discovery that Lincoln understood so well.
Somewhere in there was a message.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about some of the changes and appointments that Obama has made since he's been in office. One of the most important things he's done is that in April of this year, he formed the PCAST, which is a council that represents leaders from many scientific disciplines who will basically advise the president on a broad range of issues. Some of the people in charge of this council are John Holdren, who is in the position of science and technology, Eric Lander, who is director of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, and he's also one of the leaders of the Human Genome Project, and Harold Varmus, who is a former head of the National Institute of Health and a Nobel laureate. In May of this year, Obama appointed John P. Holdren as the assistant to the president for science and technology policy. Now, Mr. Holdren is a very interesting character. He holds advanced degrees in aerospace engineering and theoretical plasma physics from MIT and Stanford. And prior to his appointment, he was director of science, technology, and public policy at Harvard. One thing, I tried to find this clip for y'all, but in one of his very first public speeches once he was nominated, it was on NPR. And he was asked by a caller who was very youngish whether any of the technologies from Star Trek were going to be happening anytime soon. And he said, just completely serious, that he said, well, I think that transporters are going to be tough. But we've made some great advances in cloaking.
Well, phasers. They could have phasers.
Phasers too. Would be nice. Yeah. And he also said that his favorite Star Trek technology was the warp plasma drive. And he reminded the kid, oh, by the way, I do have a degree in that. another important appointment was Andrew McLaughlin in June. Mr. McLaughlin is probably best known for his handling of the pressure of Google's policies regarding their information exchange in China and how China tried to basically prevent them from allowing certain information in. Obama also created some new positions. In March of this year, Mr. Vivek Kundra was, he was appointed as the Chief Information Officer. And Mr. Kundra has a really, got my slides out of order. Mr. Kundra, before he was, or as since he's been nominated, has done some pretty impressive projects. One of the first things he did was the creation of data.gov. And this is a fantastic website, which you can basically allows the public to get the raw data, like machine-readable raw data, that the government has generated and then use it for any purpose, which is a great way to track what the government is doing and how the money is being spent. Another thing he's done is he's launched in 2009 something known as the Federal IT Dashboard. And that's a way the public can look at and assess all of the IT projects that the government is working on. In May, Anish Chopra was appointed as the CTO, or the Chief Technology Officer. And his previous experience was as Virginia's Technology Officer. And he did some really amazing initiatives while he was there. A couple of them are he created the first, it's called a Flexbook, and it's a physics textbook that's online, and it supplements immediately through teachers and contributions all the most modern data. He also created iTunes U, or he integrated that with University Virginia school system so that students could actually download lesson plans to their iPod. All right, federal spending. This is where Obama's policies start to really get serious. I mean, really, when it comes down to it, the money that's poured into science, education, and research is going to have a dramatic effect on this country's future. In April of 2009, Obama stated his goal was to devote more than 3% of our GDP to scientific research and development. And that's really a stunning amount. And as part of the stimulus bill, Obama's committed $21.5 billion for scientific research and development. The stimulus bill also has a $75 billion credit to make tax cuts permanent for scientific research. One thing Obama has been pretty strongly criticized in the news for is slashing the military's budget. But as I performed some research on this, it's not exactly what you think. Obama has criticized lawmakers and the Pentagon for projects that he considers wasteful or exotic. And a good example of that locally is the F-22, which just in Georgia employed 25,000 workers. And that's something that is pretty sure going to get phased out. And his budget does have deep cuts in a lot of other weapon systems. But surprisingly, his military and defense budget is the largest one in history. It's actually a raise from last year. He did do cuts in certain technology areas, but he's actually increased spending in defense in other technology areas that he considers more viable. And this is a video I thought that gave a great example of exotic spending that was cut from the budget. All right.
Is brought to you by 500 Days of Summer in select theaters July 17th.
As part of President Obama's commitment to reduce Pentagon spending, today the White House announced it plans to scrap the multi-billion dollar program to build a gigantic tank in the shape of a dragon. Joining us now is a critic of the cut, retired General Theodore Cotty.
Hello, Brandon.
General Cotty, opponents of the dragon tank point to things like its $10 million fangs and $35 million prehensile robotic tail and say this is somewhat
Look,
excessive.
Brandon, developing new technology is essential to maintaining America's military advantage.
Yes, of course, I understand.
Just last week, for example, we figured out how to make the dragon scales glow in the dark.
Oh, yes, but where are the limits for this kind of spending?
Look, the Pentagon is reasonable. I mean, we've eliminated the pool and the ballroom in the stomach of the dragon.
But the final plan still called for a 1,000,000-watt external stereo system.
Well, the stereo system was a necessity.
I see here its purpose was to, quote, play the dragon's fearsome roar as it approaches the enemies, sending them scattering like field mice.
Look, we need technology for tomorrow's battlefield, like the laser that sets a mile-wide skull-shaped area of land on fire.
But
or the cyber armor, so after one of our troops is shot, his body will keep firing guns while rock music plays.
So canceling projects like these is going to put future generations of Americans in danger.
Absolutely. We've made this mistake before. When Bill Clinton was elected, he canceled the giant invisible squid submarine project, and then the USS Cole was bombed.
Well, that's true, but the military has had 5 years to complete the Dragon.
Was the atomic bomb or karate developed in 5 years?
I understand.
President Obama is putting lives at risk. The only explanation I can think of is that he's terrified of dragons.
House insiders say the president may even push to take down that all-seeing eye from the top of the Washington Monument.
He'll face a lot of resistance there. The eye's become a crucial part of Homeland Security. It costs a lot to maintain, but it sees all.
Well, General Cotty, thank you for your time. I appreciate your being here.
You're welcome, Brent.
Coming up next, the new Harry Potter film is encouraging more children to see movies made from books.
Everyone, this is Summer.
That's great. I hadn't seen them.
Onion podcast. They've got a lot of great videos.
Yes.
And it's kind of a joke subject, but when I was talking about the F-22 earlier, that's a project which has run into the billions, and it's a plane that's never been used in military combat.
One comment about the F-22, I believe it was Senator O'Bay from Wisconsin in the appropriations bill in 96, whenever the project was funded, included a provision saying we can't sell the F-22 to allies until it's discontinued. So there's probably a political play there because the Japanese and the Australians and the Israelis want to get their hands on the F-22, and we can't sell it until it's discontinued.
Very interesting point.
Doesn't make sense. I'm just saying that doesn't make sense. Is it supposed to not make sense? Oh, wait, this is government. I keep forgetting. All right.
We've done that in the past. Our old, out-of-date models.
Ah.
So when it's not sold anymore, it's out of date.
So we're the
they get hand-me-downs.
We're the hand-me-down country. I love it.
Oh, yeah. We sell cruisers. For years, we sold... You know, Brazil Navy has had several of our cruisers from World War II for years.
But never when they're in current production here.
Right, they go out.
That's amazing. Cool.
I mean, I didn't know that. The Sabre, Super Sabre, F-104, all those have been flown till recent years.
Cool. All right. Hand me down nation. Mm-hmm.
Why would you want other countries to have the same technology we have?
Today, but they may not always be our allies.
Never trust the Australians.
And that has been a problem because with Iraq, one of those, has a lot of our current technology or old technology.
Iran.
Yeah, one of those does. I forget which one. I'm so up on this.
I mean, things like Britain would probably be able to save money.
What do you think?
That's an assumption we don't know.
Well, I mean...
Hold up. If you're going to speak, can you raise your hand and then let him come over to you with the mic so everyone can hear?
Yeah. Sorry.
It's cool. But
who was it? You
know. We allied ourselves with the same Mujahideen who are killing American soldiers today back under Clinton when we were in Croatia and Bosnia. So we gave them guns. Afghanistan in the 80s when the Russians were sucking there like we are today, we backed those same people that are killing Americans today. So allies become enemies overnight. Not always, but...
It goes way back. The four plants from the 30s were disassembled and moved to Russia, Siberia, to build the Russian tanks that were used in the campaign against the Nazis, which then was used in the campaign to subjugate Europe, which was the same tanking plants that were making the tanks, C-62 and C-72 series, that was sitting across Fulda Gap for all those wonderful years. So, you know, technology gets loose.
Mm-hmm. All right, great points. One thing that I think is really was one of the most surprising things when I was researching this speech is, as we stated earlier, President Bush really has this aura of just, you know, negative science, negative education, negative spending on these type of matters. But in 2006, he created what was called the American Competitiveness Initiative. And it basically was a plan to double the budget for research and science to $50 billion by 2016. And as I mentioned earlier, Obama made a promise to double the budget of science and research by 2016. It's the same plan. It's the, and what's most interesting is that under Bush, the spending on science and research and development was actually raised at a much higher rate than the current administration's. In fact, if Obama's going to stay on track to reach that goal, he's really going to have to start significantly raising over the next few years the amount of money poured into research and design. All right, an issue that's kind of close to my heart is in the campaign, one of the hardest issues to find anything mentioned on was on patent reform. It's just really not a sexy issue. He did state in his campaign that he would give increased resources to the Patent and Trademark Office. One of the reasons for that is that officers at the USPTO usually leave within 1 year, and it's just to get a law firm job. To be a patent officer, you have to have an advanced science degree, so engineering, physics, chemistry, biology. And with that, you then have to take a patent bar, which is an incredibly difficult test. It's basically having to understand the entire code involved in patent law, which is about 6 inches thick. And you get paid around $40,000 a year, and your chances for increase are less than $1,000 a year. So it's one of those things that looks great on your resume, but once you learn your job, you're usually out the door looking for the next thing.
And we can see the result of that, especially in the area of software patents, that there's patents being granted all the time that those of us in the industry look at and go, that's blatantly obvious. I mean, these guys were doing it, you know, 8 years before the patent was awarded. And so we've had to fight these things over and over again, and it's cost energy and time and threatened development. And we're trying to get ahead in a technological, innovative way, and yet patents are screwing us up.
Mm-hmm. And that's one other thing you mentioned, is he did want to open up the patent process to review so that, you know, when Microsoft or IBM or any of these corporations are just getting, they literally get thousands of patents a year. They're blanket patents. They're just trying to grasp at the edge of innovation and cover anything possible, whether or not it's something they use or have actually developed. And by opening it up to the community, people like him who say, look, that's been done years ago, then instead of all this being done in secrecy, which is the way it's done now, that patent can get automatically removed. And that would really significantly drop the cost of litigation. And a good example of that is if you're sued by a company for patent infringement, the cost to defend yourself through trial is on average $1.5 to $2 million. So even if at the end of the trial you win, you're probably going to be bankrupt. And then the larger companies, some of them use this as an actual strategy. They will use a portfolio of patents, say you're infringing, sue you, and then whether you win or lose the case, you're now so deeply in debt that at bankruptcy, they will buy all of your intellectual property rights and then add them to their portfolio so they can do it again.
Isn't that business?
That is business.
I mean, where's the problem? If a company can't keep up, like, they're going to fall to the side. Like any creature, the strong prevail, the weak die off.
Well, I guess the biggest harm is that a lot of times there is not actual patent infringement. They're just BS claims.
And then if that's the case, then have the courts turn around and say, this was a silly lawsuit. Now we're going to not only make you pay these people for all their costs, we're going to give them this patent and they can turn around and countersue you for filing a frivolous lawsuit against them.
There are provisions for that, but the biggest problem is that I would say 99% of the judges that are sitting on the bench today have no technical background. So the difference between what a frivolous case is to someone who has, you know, 20 years experience in software versus someone who has never sent an email, to them, it's all confusing. They can't tell whether or not it's a real claim or not. But look, they put on this huge show. There had to be something. So.
Well, they created special vaccine courts for people who have problems with vaccines. Why can't they create special courts for these, like special technology courts? If we're gonna, I mean, it's not like it'd be more government waste, considering 99.9% of our government is waste.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. And with what you're talking about, the vaccine case, it was designated as a public health issue. And as soon as that got out, there was serious pressure to create those courts. Whereas with technology, A lot of the major software corporations love the current system. So they use their lobbyists to keep it exactly the way it is.
So you start a grassroots campaign, this man's company, and I'm sure he knows plenty of small businesses, so to speak, get together and say, okay, Joe Smith, here's my congressman. John Doe's yours. We're going to email and fax and file and write letters and show up at their offices and make our elected officials work for us rather than let these big corporations continue to dominate us. I mean, they've been taking advantage of the 14th Amendment since the 1800s and the robber barons. Mm-hmm. So if we the people don't stand up, then we can't have sympathy for ourselves or anybody else who's not willing to stand up. If you gotta eat a bullet, eat a bullet. But do what's right for you and yours. Mm-hmm. And I guess quit whining about these corporations.
I think your idea of a grassroots campaign is fantastic. And that's actually my last slide, is there are currently quite a few fantastic organizations. And EFF is one of them. It's an organization dedicated to protecting the public's intellectual property rights. Scientists and Engineers for America is another fantastic organization that's dedicated to keeping science in legislation in the government. And there's even a website and an organization called Patent Busters. And the whole goal is they put out what they call bounties on patents. Like right now on Apple's multi-touch patent, I think there's a $50,000 bounty. If you can provide what's called prior art, and prior art is proof that this technology existed before they patented it, it will invalidate their patent. So if you're the person who can find this proof and get it to the patent office, that business has $50,000 they will give you.
Sounds to me like they've created new jobs.
Absolutely.
Have you felt any of the effects of this patent reform yet, being in the business? Have you seen any?
From my standpoint, very little. One thing he has done is that he has nominated a new director of the USPTO. And it's a guy that's immensely qualified. And he's only been in office, I think, going on a month now. So he really hasn't had a chance to make any big changes. One thing he has done is that to file a patent, the fees are currently, I think it's around $1,500 that goes straight to the government. And so the government generates, or the patent office generates, quite a bit of fees. And for the last 20 years, a huge chunk of that, instead of going to the patent office to upgrade, to get new technology to pay its employees, has been siphoned off to other organizations. And so the first thing he's doing is making it a policy that all fees generated by the patent office will then go back into it to streamline it, to get better employees, to keep the good employees they have and retain them. So I think that should really help. Because right now the average wait is 3 to 3.5 years for your first office action, which means from the day you file your patent, you won't hear back from the government for 3.5 years. In fact, I haven't had a single patent that I filed. I haven't gotten a response from a single one. And I've been doing this for a couple of years. Go ahead.
Doesn't that make patents kind of irrelevant?
Because at the rate that technology changes today, I mean, in 3.5 years, something would be completely out of date.
Sort of. And that's what's kind of tricky about patent law. I'm trying to think of a good way to, or a good analogy for this. An alarm clock. I guess that's kind of a decent example. And this is going to be kind of a rough sketch, but it's the basic idea. The first person who invented the clock, say they got a patent on it, and then someone comes along and says, wouldn't it be a great idea if the clock had an alarm so that, you know, not only does it tell time, but it goes off and wakes you up? Well, they can patent the alarm clock, but here's where it gets tricky. If someone holds the patent on the clock, and that's part of the alarm clock, they have the right to prevent someone from making, using, or selling any clock in the United States. So even though you have a patent on the alarm clock, you can't make it, you can't use it, you can't sell it, because a fundamental part of it is patented. Now, the person who owns the clock can't make an alarm clock because someone else holds the patent. So the only way the person who now holds an alarm clock patent can make it is to get the permission or a license from the holder of the other patent.
Or move to China.
Right. And so, because patents last for 20 years, if you can get something key to any sort of technology, like in software, if you can patent certain things like Microsoft, when you move your mouse around the screen, you know it's an arrow and then it'll change to a hand or another symbol. They have over 14 different patents on that. And if they wanted to, any program that uses mouse cursor changes, they could sue you and say you're infringing our patent. They don't, but using that type of system, I mean, if you can get basic parts of a technology patented, anyone who comes along, even if they have the best, most fantastic upgrade to it, can't do it without their permission.
Yeah, which is silly because what you just described was being done at Xerox PARC in 1974, so that, I'm sure that's prior art, so it's a matter of fighting this patent.
Right. So, yeah, there's a lot to be done in the patent reform process, and it's causing a lot of huge issues. And just kind of off topic, but I'll throw it out there. One of the biggest reasons patent reform is not happening is because two of the most powerful lobbyists are completely at each other's throat on the reform system. On one hand, you've got the software industry, which hates the current system because of this uncertainty of who has a patent. You know, with most things that are technological, that you can really wrap your mind around, you can point to something and say, that physical object is now part of that patent. Whereas in software, it's a very amorphous. You know, it doesn't really exist in life, so it's very hard to define what is and isn't something that's been patented. Whereas in the medical industry, they love the patent system because all of their products, like a drug, is a very unique, specific item. And so the patent system works for them perfectly. And so because both of those organizations really have the most money in our economy, one wants it changed, one doesn't, nothing has been done. Patent reform has been in legislation since, I think, 2001, and every year nothing happens. Every year there's a big, you know, cry in the government that this year we're going to make it, and every year, next year. Next year we'll get it done. All right, another big promise that Obama in his campaign stated as his pro-science, pro-technology policy was that he wanted to massively expand the availability of broadband access, especially in rural and low-income areas. These are the areas that an access provider hasn't laid lines in just because it's not profitable to do so. Can we get sound?
Yeah.
Give our children the chance to live out their dreams in a world that's never been more competitive. We will equip tens of thousands of schools, community colleges, and public universities with 21st century classrooms, labs, and libraries. We'll provide new computers, new technology, and new training for teachers so that students in Chicago and Boston can compete with children in Beijing for the high-tech, high-wage jobs of the future. To build an economy that can lead this future, we will begin to rebuild America. Yes, we'll put people to work repairing crumbling roads, bridges, and schools by eliminating the backlog of well-planned, worthy, and needed infrastructure projects. But we'll also do more to retrofit America for a global economy. That means updating the way we get our electricity by starting to build a new smart grid that will save us money, protect our power sources from blackout or attack, and deliver clean, alternative forms of energy to every corner of our nation. It means expanding broadband lines across America so that a small business in a rural town can connect and compete with their counterparts anywhere in the world. It means investing in the science, research, and technology that will lead to new medical breakthroughs, new discoveries, and entire new industries.
Okay, on broadband, I think this is one of Obama's best success stories so far. In the federal budget and in the Recovery Act, there's $7.2 billion that's going to be spent nationwide on deploying an infrastructure for broadband access. And this really, do you have a question?
How is that under any stretch of the Constitution a federal project?
Think of roads, think of telephone lines. Things like that.
It's broadband. At best, it might be a local issue. At the very best. You're saying it's one of his successes. I think it's one of the worst things he's done.
Yeah, I agree. It's going to be one of the... I'm intrinsically involved with network technology, and It's going to be one of the biggest waste of money we have seen in this century. It is going to be, you know, the money's just going to disappear. I mean, if you want to do that project, you're talking maybe $3 trillion to be able to provide broadband to everybody in this country. You know, this $700 billion is nothing. I build projects that are network projects in a single building that cost $40 to $80 million. So, you know, $7 billion is chump change for a network that trying to deliver what he's promising. So that number, that $7 billion, is a joke. It is a big joke. It's like saying, you know, hey, I'm going to go out and buy a car, and I'm going to spend $10. I'm going to get a real fast car. Who would believe you?
And that's a great point, is that when you talk about numbers in the billions, you know, it's very hard to even wrap your mind around the concept. But when you talk about things, you know, as far as nationwide, you know, T1 lines or T3 lines, you know, it's very hard to conceive of what $7 billion could actually accomplish.
$7 billion will... T1? T3? E3? Oh. We're laying down 10 gigabit.
Mm-hmm. Optical?
Of course, optical. Yeah. And I've got a metro link that's 40T. Mm-hmm. Go, and you know, we're looking at a short haul, you know, 50-100 kilometer tall haul. We're looking at, you know, 100 to 150T for communications. And, you know, to be able to provide that sort of bandwidth and the aggregation of bandwidth for all kind of universal access, you're looking at, one, you can forget about our current infrastructure structure of our core routing environment, because it will not, you know, you're looking at a whole new concept of being able to develop that sort of traffic. I mean, literally, it is a joke. It is a freaking joke, because, I mean, I'm involved with a high compute processing, and, you know, my backbone is currently running a 2.8 tera, and I'm looking at maybe within the next 2 to 3 years, you know, taking my infrastructure backbone up to maybe 4 to 7 tera, and it's, you know, and the money to be able to kind of do that, and still, even with that size of a backbone, you're probably looking at a nationwide backbone, probably in the peta. Mm-hmm. To be able to pass that traffic. And architecturally, the current architecture of the wide area network cannot handle that kind of traffic in a central trunk routing environment where you have a current backbone. Technologically, the IP4 and IP6 is not designed for that kind of environment. So saying that you're going to throw $7 billion and solve this problem and provide internet access to everybody, it's might as well, you know, saying that the moon is made of cheese and I'm going to go to the moon to drill for oil and have cheese oil. I mean, it's like those Russian, you ever saw those movies from the Soviet Union in the 50s promoting their space program, how it's going to be, and they had oil bubbling up on the ground and that's how they were going to pay for it? It's the same sort of joke.
I think there's a question behind you.
She brought up a good point about the Constitution. I have a copy in my pocket, and I'm not a lawyer, I'm just a citizen, but I don't see anything about the internet or providing for public education in the Constitution. And where is this money gonna come from? And if it's coming from me, the people, I don't care if somebody in Nowhereville, South Dakota has the internet. Let them get a job. Let them provide for themselves, take a little personal responsibility and action for their own selves, and leave me alone. I don't want to pay for this. She obviously doesn't want to pay for this. Why should we have to pay for this? This is a waste, more wasteful, more and more waste.
It is.
And you, as a small business owner, I'm not saying small as in a derogatory thing, but the government taking over industry, it's going to put you out of business eventually.
Yeah, so. I don't see any possibility at this point of an economy of scale. I mean, it would make sense for the government to get involved if there was an economy of scale at some point. But this is the kind of thing that's best solved, as you said, so well, it's at a local level. You know, let local and regional governments take a look at it, and even if it's, and it may not even be their job either. I mean, it may be that it's really up to, as you said, you know, let's let the capitalists at it. Let's figure it out that way. Question somewhere behind you?
Oh, but with WiMAX and LTE coming down the pike, mm-hmm. you know, we're not going to be laying cables anymore.
And, that was the point I wanted to
bring up. In Africa, they don't use landline phones because it's just easier to put wireless in. So mm-hmm. the private sector is already working on this. It's just the timetable that the president wants versus where the technology is actually going. Give it 10 years, and everyone's going to have broadband no matter where they're at.
Maybe.
I mean, it reminds me sort of similar, I guess 10 or 15 years ago, you'd go out to places out west in the valleys and stuff where they couldn't get cable TV or anything like that because it didn't make any economic sense to lay cable out that far because there weren't enough people to support it. And it seems crazy that we would spend all of this money when in 5 or 10 years the technology is going to change and we wouldn't have had to have spent any of the money. Mm-hmm. And Dish Network, I think, beams internet access to you if you want it now, don't they?
There are satellite access mechanisms, but they're slow.
HughesNet does it.
One of the things that I have personal experience with is, and this has been rolled out in some of the cities, is the MetroFi project, the ability to put Wi-Fi all the way through the city. So from Portland, Oregon, where I'm from, MetroFi came in and said, this is what we're going to do for you, and our local government believed what they said. And it ended up costing the city a lot of money. And like we have these totally useless devices deployed on light poles all over Portland metro area now. And there wasn't enough money in the if we go bankrupt bond to now pay for those to be taken down. So we have a problem. We can't even afford to take them down. And if this is government getting involved in broadband, it's not a good idea.
I can give you an example of government involvement with technology. This is mainly through my father, from the 40s on to the 70s. My father was an aviation technician involved with high-end aircraft for corporate business. And in the 1950s, they started developing microwave landing systems. Okay, and they developed the microwave landing systems, and basically they developed a landing system in contrary to what the currently was in use and probably still in use called ILS mm-hmm. landing system. They developed in the 50s, late early 60s, for a microwave landing system. They proposed, the provider provides the solution to the government. And they said, look at this nice new system we have. We can turn people onto final within a half mile to a quarter mile. We can have people coming from any direction, and we can provide absolute precision guidance for about 50 miles of airspace around the airport. The government said, we only know how to drive them down a line 20 miles off the runway. And they re-engineered the solution so that it looked just like the ILS system and also made sure that it had the same problems that the ILS system had. So the government involvement in technology is a really is a limited scope ideal in terms of if you they tend to they do what they do designed to do. Government is designed to find political solutions.
Yeah, I was going to say that they're not the customer ultimately. Mm-hmm. You know, we the people are the customer, but we have this giant agent acting in theory on our behalf.
They are a political agency, which you have to have to have society, but they will seek political answers, and technology will always be secondary if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. And that's why this Obama administration is no different than the Bush administration, than the Johnson administration, than the Eisenhower administration, than these all administrations. We're just the people just have new masters to please with the pet projects. Mm-hmm. It's not going to produce any fount of knowledge. I mean, to give you an example, you had the DNA project, you know, mapping the genome. Was that a big government solution? No. It was a guy who was driving down the road and suddenly realized how to replicate DNA in the lab in mass quantities. Yeah. And it was just pure innovation on his part. You know, it had nothing to do with any big grand design or anything. He was just a guy steering into space late one night, flying over the roads at a high speed, breaking the law, somewhere in California, Highway 1 probably. And I saw an interview with him years ago. And so I don't see Obama's big technology show as being more than more of the show.
Okay, a couple points. I do think that a lot of the best stories about innovation do come from individuals. But I do think there are definitely projects where you have to have collaboration and you have to have funding. And there are certain instances where private institutions, I think, are the best way to do it. And then there are times, and I'm sure people can argue about whether the space race or you know, the Large Hadron Collider, things of this scope, which are literally in the billions of dollars, which there is no economic sense other than the pursuit of knowledge to pursue them. You're not going to make money, but you will expand, you know, our abilities as humans to understand science or the universe. So I do think if you're looking at it from a purely fiscal policy, then definitely keep technology out of government. As far as how we spend the money in government, I think this is really one of the best things you can come out of here thinking about, is really our government is just people. And I've met quite a few politicians, and most of them, I know people have really negative opinions of them, they really are just good people who are really trying. But think about, in your own life, we're all knowledgeable in certain areas. And I'm a pretty tech-savvy guy, but a lot of this, you know, like the broadband stuff is really just way over my head. And I have a pretty, I have a degree that's not too far from it. Most politicians are expected to be experts on everything. Everything from farming to, you know, how a city's run to how technology works. And no one person can do that. So if something about how the government's being run bothers you, you know, that's your job as a citizen, is to call your local congressman or call your representative and say, hey, if you have a question on this subject, I can fill you in. And I'll tell you from personal experience, if you offer to help some, you know, a representative, they're usually thrilled to have it. Pretty much every day, they get hundreds of calls complaining about what they're doing wrong. But they usually get one a day of one person offering to help them out. So, I mean, if you've got ideas or opinions, or say, hey, wait a few years, wait for WiMAX, don't waste our money on cable, tell your congressman. He'll pass it up, and maybe a bill can be proposed to delay the spending or to reserve the money for a future date. All right, for...
I think that's a good point, that we need to offer our assistance and our expertise, but I think you also make a good point that needs to be elaborated on, which is we've got 565 people whose best skill is getting elected. Mm-hmm. None of them, I mean, for the most part, they're not experts in anything. A few of them certainly are. And these are the people who are making the decisions. And that's all the more reason why these complicated decisions like technology and healthcare and all these very complex issues do not need to be made at that level. They're not the people who have the expertise. And I think that wasn't exactly your point, but I think that's what I take from what you just said. And that's...
And no, that's a very interesting issue. Right now, there's a big debate as far as in political theory on how you fill these offices, these tech offices. There are certain ones that are elected, and there are certain ones that are appointed. Now, and you made a point that I think is fantastic. If you get elected to an office, you have to spend the majority of your time getting elected, not doing stuff in your office. Whereas if you get appointed, then you're just usually hand-picked, which means you could be doing your job whether you have skills. I mean, were you chosen because of your background and your knowledge, or because you're golf buddies with, you know, your congressman or the president? And that's one thing I thought, whether he acts on it or not, his policy to appoint people based on their background and their skills and their expertise. And so far, his choices have not been political buddies. I mean, these are people whose scientific credentials are outstanding.
Well, yes. I was, wow. A lot of great points here. My personal opinion, of course, on the federal level, if the bill is too complicated for the legislatures to understand, then the correct vote is no, until whatever bill they're considering is understandable. As far as communicating with people, don't underestimate your state level representatives. Find out who they are. Invite him or her to lunch. Mm-hmm. Make a friend. People do favors for friends, including introducing bills and resolutions. And if the state of Georgia, for example, passes a resolution basically telling the federal government we do not approve of this program, we will not participate, we will do everything in our power to obstruct it, that carries a lot more weight than even a bunch of people complaining directly to the elected officials who tend to want to go along with their friends in Washington instead of the people who sent them there.
I agree with what the guy said behind me 100%, but the last time our state stood up and did that was, what, 1860, and we were invaded by a foreign country and they never left.
All right, I'm going to skip that topic. I think that could go on for a couple hours. Who here can tell me about net neutrality? All right, wait, we got one more question or answer.
Well, I just wanted to make a point. I love the government bash fest as much as anyone, mm-hmm. But the point you made earlier about offering help, mm-hmm. don't just go and complain or say, hey, I don't want this program, but it's these guys need experts, and if those experts come from their constituency, so much the better. Make yourself into that advisor, that person who knows the topic, who can advise them, instead of just saying, hey, this, you're an idiot for thinking this is a good plan.
Mm-hmm. And I just tweeted that. It's already been retweeted, so apparently that's a good idea. My 4,700 followers now know about this, so it'll spread.
All right, I think we had a volunteer to tell us about net neutrality. If you don't mind, can you give us the pros and the cons?
Okay, basically you realize that the internet is really a conglomeration of corporations and peer-to-peer relationships managing a data flow between the various organizations. They're being passed at the level that we see it as being passed as packets. These packets are then flowing out of your machine. They are each labeled with a destination address and various other wonderful information, which I could draw you a diagram about, but we don't have time. So these packets then flow to these destination addresses. And these corporations and organizations have agreed to basically maintain a table of destination addresses, and then they have all agreed to pass each other's traffic at equal value to each other. In other words, no traffic is delayed because it's between any particular two endpoints. Or they will agree to examine deeper into the packets and look for what kind of type of packets they are and make a decision also based on that, just that decision based on that packet type. Now, some within certain organizations, within dealing with certain corporations, you can pay with them to basically prioritize traffic and for your own use. But in a general sense, in dealing with a ubiquity of traffic paths at all equal weights between the organizations. The corporations now are getting both sides of the equation. They are now also providers of information, and also they are routers of the packets themselves. So they are starting to say to themselves or to various co-linked organizations, saying, we will prioritize traffic for your destinations for a cost, and for even a better cost, we'll deprioritize traffic to your competitors.
And that's really the biggest thing, is that since the internet has been around, the model has been one of equal access, and that regardless of who you are, your packets are generally treated just like anyone else's. And so what's being, proposed by providers and companies is they want to be able to charge people for the service. And so that if a large corporation wants its data to have a higher priority, it will go through. but they can also prevent others from going through.
And it's more about priority. It's not just about priority. That's also about complete blockage.
Right. They may block BitTorrent or peer-to-peer. All these things that a lot of people use daily that could be completely shut down.
Now, as a specific example of this, where you, the corporation wearing two different hats, one is the net provider and also as a content provider, Comcast put a 250 gig a month cap in place. But the cap does not apply to movies purchased through the Comcast on-demand movie system. So in other words, if I run an on-demand movie service and I'm trying to ship it to you, a Comcast customer, the bytes you buy from me will go against your 250 gig cap, but the bytes you buy from Comcast for their on-demand movie system won't. And this is an example where the wearing of two hats is getting us into trouble in the marketplace. And consumers are almost clueless about this, because it really does take a fair amount of knowledge to make good policy on this and even understand it. And of course, the people being courted, the congressional people being courted to make policy decision about this are the big players, Comcast and the others, because they've got their hand in the pie. Decisions aren't being considered fairly, I think. And this is again a place where we as individuals, once we get informed about this, need to stand up and say, look, I want last mile neutrality. I don't want my provider of my net packets, who also happens to be an entertainment provider, to be deciding and prioritizing packets on that.
Okay, it's sound.
Ooh, okay.
As president, I intend to work with you to write the next chapter in the story of American innovation. That's part of the reason why I'm running for president of the United States. To seize this moment, we have to ensure free and full exchange of information. And that starts with an open internet. I will take a backseat to no one in my commitment to network neutrality. Because once providers start to privilege some applications or websites over others, then the smaller voices get squeezed out and we all lose. The internet is perhaps the most open network in history, and we have to keep it that way.
That was during his campaign.
Yeah.
Thanks. His actions since he's been elected have actually been really pro-net net neutrality. In March of this year, he picked Julius Genachowski as the new FCC chief. And Genachowski actually worked with Obama during his campaign. He was the one who was in charge of crafting Obama's campaign message on net neutrality. In May of this year, Obama then again reaffirmed that he would like to commit to net neutrality and to keeping the internet open and free. And just a few days ago, the FCC chief stated that he is committed to not only protecting net neutrality, but they may start prosecuting companies who violate its tenets. All right. Next, we're going to talk a little bit about copyright law, but I just wanted to give a quick rundown for those of you who aren't really familiar with it on how it works. The Constitution reads that Congress shall have the power to promote the progress of science by securing for limited times to authors the exclusive right to their respective writings. And that phrase was interpreted and has basically created copyright law. Copyright gives a author of any form of creative work, and that can be anything from music to literature to sculpture, even software, the right to a personal monopoly for up to 70 years, although that's constantly getting expanded for corporations.
Whenever Mickey Mouse would become public domain, it gets extended.
Yeah, it's never going to happen.
Right.
What copyright does is it gives the author the right to prevent others from showing, copying, performing, modifying, and most importantly, distributing their work without their permission. And it basically copies, and that's where, you know, when you hear about downloading music, all it is you're violating their right to distribute their music. So when you copy and allow it to be shared or downloaded illegally, you're violating these rights of the author. There are some limits to copyrights. The most important of these is the first sale doctrine. And that means that if I buy a CD from a store, under strict copyright law, I could not then resell it because that would be distributing it. But the first sale doctrine says that if you legally purchase any copyrightable item from the author or from an author's distributor, you then have the right to distribute that work of art, but only in the form you purchased it. So you can't make copies and then distribute copies. You can only sell or give away even the copy that you purchased. Another very important exclusion to copyright laws is what's known as fair use. And this really balances the need between the public and the creator of the work for its use. Fair use can really come into a lot of areas, but a good example is if you're reporting on a subject, you can, so say you're criticizing an artwork. You can show the artwork and, you know, criticize it, but you're not selling it, so you're just commenting on it. Another is parody. So when you see on SNL when, you know, there are certain things that they may have the same music, but they're making fun of the song, they can use it as a parody of it. It's not an actual use of it.
Yeah, Weird Al once said that technically he doesn't have to obtain the rights to any of that music that he uses, but he does go in and actually get legal documents for all the music that he rewrites.
Yeah. Oh, and this is actually a good example. The fact that really, if when you worry about fair use, the most important thing is, are you making money? If you're not making money, it's very unlikely that a company is going to care that you're using their product. Because really, what copyright law is there is to protect the author. And a good example is this display, like the fact that I'm using Obama's speeches. This is not me trying to profit off Obama. This is just a teaching situation. So it would be considered fair use just for this specific instance. Okay. And during his campaign, Obama stated that we needed to update and reform our copyright system to promote civic discourse, innovation, and investment while ensuring that IP owners are fairly treated. And he also stated regarding the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, I would support in concept allowing Americans to make a backup copy of a digital product they have purchased. So he seemed, during the campaign, really kind of user-friendly on the copyright side. Some of his actions, especially his appointments to high-level government positions, haven't reflected that view. For one example, Joe Biden, who he chose as his vice president, has very strong ties to the Recording Industry Association of America. He's actually also introduced a $1 billion program last year to monitor peer-to-peer networks for illegal activity. And Biden also encouraged the Justice Department to criminally prosecute people who allowed copying of copyright items through peer-to-peer networks. Obama has also appointed Tom Perrelli to Associate Attorney General. Mr. Perrelli, he's had a very expansive legal career, so only a portion of what he's done is related to IP or copyright items, but he basically was the RAI's, our Recording Industry Association's, main lawyer. He was the one who has prosecuted the only case where a peer-to-peer user has gone to trial. He was one of the prosecutors. Question?
Did Joe Biden remember the PMRC back in the 80s?
I'm not sure what the PMRC
is.
The
Parental Music Resource Center, the ones that pretty much tried to censor bands. And
Tipper Gore's organization.
Yeah.
I'm
the ones that put the warning labels on the records you buy, or the video games you buy, or the movies you see, or they were a load of fascists, basically, who tried to tell us what we could and couldn't listen to, what was offensive and what wasn't.
That's a possibility. I just don't have any knowledge on the subject.
Biden isn't mentioned in the Wikipedia article for the PMRC. I don't know how high up a level he was, but if he was significant, he'd be in the Wikipedia article. Oh, wait, he is now. No. I love Wikipedia.
All right. Another appointment of Obama was Neil McBride, and that's as an associate deputy general. Previously, McBride was an assistant to Joe Biden, and he's responsible for the Business Software Alliance's program that paid people to phone in tips about suspected software piracy. Another pro-stringent copyright enforcement appointment was that of the FCC chairman. He is very strong on net neutrality, but he has come down very hard on any infringement of copyright. He said that you know, it's he very much respects creators' rights, and it's going to be one of his goals to enforce them. Now, this, of course, has caused a backlash for some of Obama supporters who were really thinking he was going to give consumers more protection in copyright policy. Is anyone here familiar with copyleft? I'll let you talk.
Oh, okay.
You want to tell them what it is?
Copyleft, you're talking about the Free Software Foundation's mm-hmm. thing? Yeah. It's a way of saying that I want to make sure that everybody who receives my intellectual property also in turn has the right to share that with others. In other words, it's a forced sharing rather than a forced protecting.
Right. It's basically a way of using copyright, existing copyright law, to create a license. And this license states that if you receive this work, and whether it's a writing or a software program, you're receiving it free and clear. But, except for one restriction, that restriction is that if you use this or modify it in any way to create something else, you must then pass it also free and clear under a copyleft license. So basically, anyone who uses something that's been copylefted and then creates a new product must then also allow it to be used by free for others to modify.
So it's a viral licensing, basically, or viral copyright.
Absolutely. And there's a number of organizations that really support it. The EFF is one. There's a couple others you just mentioned.
Well, the Free Software Foundation is the one that created it, but it's in the backbone of a lot of what makes free software and open software available. If you've heard of Linux or Firefox or any of those major projects that have created and channeled a lot of people together to make software that's available both free in cost, but also free in the choice of being able to make derived work for it and share that with others.
Right. In this letter, they've requested that Obama, look, you're starting to stack the deck with RIA insiders. You know, please, in your future appointments, start picking people outside of that industry. They've also urged him to, within the agencies, create one that really tries to support consumer rights, not just the authors.
Yeah, Creative Commons is another family of licenses that would fall under the same area.
But isn't this like copyleft? It's a great idea, but that, once again, is industry working hand-in-hand with industry, so to speak, and no government interference. Adding government interference into that is going to cause problems in the future. It always does. I mean, shouldn't we have less government involvement in this and more your company working with somebody else, working with somebody else? You don't need mommy and daddy president and vice president telling you what to do with what's yours.
I think the point here, though, is that if higher level government is aware of things like copyleft and Creative Commons, there will be fewer laws like the DMCA passed in the future. Right. I think it's about awareness. It's not just about the one-sided view of the RIAA.
And keep in mind that anything intellectual property, anything from patents, copyrights, trademarks, trade secrets, all of that exists only because of the government, only because of the laws. And those exist in whatever form that we choose through legislation. And so what they're saying is that we have copyrights, we want there to be protection for authors, but we don't want it to shift so strongly in the author's favor that the end user who then purchases it or uses it has no rights of their own.
I mean, I'm a content producer. Mm-hmm. That's what I do as my day job. And I would be very happy to completely crank back the whole copyright stuff to maybe 14 years. Because if I, as a published author, cannot make the kind of money I need to make to justify the work I put into it in the first 14 years, I'm not doing my job. And so I would really argue, I mean, we've gone way protection in author's protection at this point. We really, if we had the copyright laws in place when the Brothers Grimm wrote Snow White originally, we wouldn't have Disney to mm-hmm. exist because they would not be able to use the Snow White story. So it's really sort of ironic that Disney and that group and are all pushing to make it longer and longer because we'll never have public domain stories to tell our kids.
Well, one of the other things that the third point that you had on that previous slide mm-hmm. is something to keep in mind too. You know, RIAA is a great example of an industry that is trying to trample over the rights of authors to protect their financial interests, their system, their establishment, and quite frankly, I don't know how outside of government-based reform you're going to be able to dial back their power and put power back into the hands of the independent artist.
And that's the thing, is with the existing laws on the books, until those are changed, the status quo is going to remain the same. Okay, another huge campaign topic for Obama was really the modernization of the government's use of technology and to ensure that the government's network and computer infrastructure was protected against cyber attacks. he's done a few actions so far addressing cybersecurity. In February of this year, he ordered a review of basically how the government uses technology, what its existing infrastructure was, and in May of this year, he discussed the report that was generated on that. And he said that, look, you know, the government is not as prepared as it should be.
Sorry, I'll stop snickering.
No, it's true. The government really, I mean, think of how many things run off the government's computer systems, and power, health.
And how many of those run Windows? That's right. The scary part.
And
really.
Especially how many foreign countries are upping their cyber attacks on us. I mean, some of the you know, Asian and European countries are just nonstop, are really upping their game as far as their technological capabilities to harm us.
I mean, one thing that this will never happen as long as Microsoft is still in power, but you know, if we required all government to use only open source software, where every line of the code could be evaluated for security issues and tested and available to the public, it would completely change the threat level that is possible in government. But that'll never happen as long as Microsoft continues to send money to their Congress critters. You know, it's going to be tricky to ever get that moved along. I mean, we're seeing the problem with the voting machines, for example. Without having open source for voting machines, we cannot verify that they're workable even, and then they won't have any ways of cheating. And in fact, we've seen examples just recently where, without even having access to the source code, people were able to break in using machines they purchased at an auction. So they actually got real voting machines were used in real elections, but you know, they were able to play with them and able to break into them.
I just had a question. For Microsoft, when they supply operating systems to the government, do they edit them like to take out things like, because like I know when you get Vista, you have like the Windows media player built in and all these services running. Do they take all those out?
I'm not familiar with any altered versions, because typically the purchasing agency are just buying stock software off the shelf.
With Linux, then they'd have endless customization to take out any unnecessary security breaches, wouldn't they?
Or they could hire third parties to review every line of code and then compile it from that line of, that code that's a proven base. It would be much better to have open source software from top to bottom and open data formats from top to bottom in government, but that's a whole another hour and a half talk.
Sorry.
Yeah.
No, but that's
the way,
the thing.
You can get a free product, open source, called Nlight, which will allow you to strip whatever it is you don't like out of Windows and build your own build.
Mm, cool.
Is that, you know, in furtherance of this goal, one of his big things is that he realized the nation was in serious trouble and that he was going to appoint it's called the cyber czar, an officer who was supposed to look at all these issues, come up with a plan, and start enacting it. And that was in May. And it's been months, and there's still no cyber czar. And one of the things about that's kind of troubling about this issue is this is an appointed position. There's no Senate hearing or confirmation, so his ability to get this done should be fairly immediate. And this is a very important position. His job is to coordinate and oversee federal efforts to improve the network security, set up a framework for how all of the agencies in the government, both Homeland Security, NSA, all of those interact and coordinate. And it also would set the budget priorities to figure out which of these projects would be done first. Well, as of my most recent research, was like 2 days ago, they keep saying there's someone picked, they're going to announce it in September, but they said that in June and July and August. So we're not sure what's going on there.
Did you have?
No.
Okay.
We're also running out of time.
Oh, yeah. All right, we'll try and scoot through these. I'm pretty close to being done. One big problem, I think, that has come about the plan he discussed in May is the transparency of it. The vast majority of it is still considered top secret, classified. And so we don't know what is going to be done. But this new plan is radically going to change how the government oversees and controls networks throughout the nation, both public and private. And one thing that's troubling is already mentioned that two of the biggest players in developing this are AT&T and the NSA. And if any of y'all remember the warrantless wiretapping, those were the two people involved who were complicit. And so that's really not a good sign that that's who he chose to implement this new program. He did state that in May that this should not invade private networks or compromise our privacy. But the NSA, as of a month ago, has said that we need to stop wasting time and worrying about silly issues like privacy. And they're the ones developing the program.
Don't worry about it. It's all safe. Nobody's going to find out anything that they're not supposed to.
And another part of this is a bill that's been introduced called the Rockefeller Snow Bill. And there's been a lot of concern about this because there's a provision of the bill that appears to give the White House or Obama control of basically any network during a so-called cyber emergency. And in the bill, this isn't addressed. There's no definition of what a cyber emergency is or what controls or levels he would have to follow.
I forgot my password.
That's an emergency. That bill, I think on Sunday.
Cool.
Really? Well, since we're running out of time, I want to save as much as we can for comments. So I suggest that y'all go see it Sunday because I will be too.
Yeah.
And these are some of the organizations we were talking about. Of course, EFF, which is the fantastic group that has made this panel possible. You go to their website, they're constantly putting on some of the most important and relevant attacks on legislation today. And if you are a science geek like I am, Scientists and Engineers for America is an amazing organization, and they are really encouraging scientists and engineers, people who generally shy away from public office, to start stepping up and getting in the game. Because if we want to make changes, we don't want to just be telling our representatives how to do stuff. We should be them. And it's the weekend. It's Friday. I am thrilled to be here, and I really appreciate y'all coming. So if y'all have any comments or any questions, I'd love to hear them.
I had a quick question. I was watching Fox News, I think it was week before last, and they were doing some special on, if you go to one of the government's websites, I want to say it was like change.gov or something like that, they were reviewing the legal agreement that everyone just clicks on and say, I agree. When you go to these websites, they found a clause that said, basically, if you access this website and agree to this agreement, your computer is now the property of the United States government.
That's the thing, is by accessing government websites, you're clicking what you call a shrink wrap license. And that license says that by accessing our network, we need to be able to see what's on your computer to make sure that you're not a threat. And so,
well, that's a gross violation of my right to privacy.
And that's what I'm saying. This is a huge concern. And that's something that's been released. There's a major portion of this plan which is still classified. And we have no idea what's in there.
Yeah. Sad.
Okay, you know that's crap, right?
No,
we're out of time.
I believe that it actually was. I talked to some people that had gone to the website and said they had seen that.
You can go to that website, that's true, but what that is a website meant for the dealers of the cars, or part of the car program,
so,
whatever.
So they take over businesses' information.
No, it's they're actually doing something where they know what they're getting into when they're acting as like a government broker.
You can't get into that without you can't actually get into that website without knowing ahead of time what you're going to do, and nobody who's a consumer would ever do something like that. The people who would be doing that are car dealers who are actually entering into an agreement with the government where they're going to be keeping people's private information on their, you know, on their system, and there's no way to do that accidentally. Like, the people who reported that knew ahead of time exactly what they were talking about, and it'd be impossible for a private citizen to do something like that, you know, accidentally. You have to specifically go to the site and specifically look at the agreement. You know, I mean, that's that. Yeah, it was nonsense.
Oh, whoa. Well, thank you all for coming. Enjoy the rest of the show. Come to Hacker 101 and 201. Have fun.